Yossi said. Alrighty. Title of my talk is Geometric Measure Theory. And some Neumann algebras. So throughout, M5 is going to be a trachial for Neumann algebra. And I'd like to start with a well-known example to illustrate a basic problem in operator algebras. That example is the group for Neumann algebra. So in this setup, you have a group, discrete, and you want to associate to it a Neumann algebra, so you need a Hilbert space. So your Hilbert space, the set of all complex valued functions from gamma 1 to c, which are square summable. This becomes an inner product space, a Hilbert space, in the usual way. And now, for every group element g, you define the following unitary operator. So what it does to a function f at gamma is it shifts it by g. Now, the group for Neumann algebra of gamma well, how do you get this? Well, you take all the unitaries and then you consider the algebra they generate. And then you close them in the topology of pointwise convergence. This provides you with plenty of examples of Neumann algebras, one for each discrete group. However, the drawback is that when you perform three, when you take that closure, you add so many elements that it's no longer clear what your Neumann algebra looks like, right? So, for example, as many of us know by direct experience or frustration, it's not known whether the free group factor on two generators is isomorphic to the free group factor on three generators. But it is very easy to show that at the level of algebras, they're not isomorphic. Almost thought I got that wrong. So if you want to study Neumann algebras, if you want to study invariants for them, one method to proceed would be to start at the level of generating sets themselves, instead of going to the Neumann algebra closure, which presents lots of difficulties. And this is the underlying idea in Voiculescu's free probability, and in particular his microstates approach, which is what I'm going to talk about now. So, to motivate the definition, I'm going to recall the following well-known analogy between classical and free probability. So, what do you have in classical probability? What are the objects? Well, you have a probability space. So this is just a measure space with total mass 1. You have random variables, which I'll assume are bounded. These are just bounded measurable functions from your probability space into R. And then you take a look at the moments of the random variable. So what is this? So you take your random variable, you raise it to the kth power, and you integrate it. And then you find out that the moments of your random variable completely determine its distribution. Okay, so in free probability, each one of these concepts is replaced with an analogous object. So instead of a probability space, you have a weak star probability space. And that's just the M5 that I set up from the get-go, right? It's a tracial from Norman algebra. Instead of a bounded random variable, you have an n tuple of self-adjoints. And instead of the moments, you have the non-commutative moments. So what these are the following. So it's a Feynman algebra, so it's usually going to be non-commutative, so you have to take into account the order in which you multiply elements. So now we're going to consider the trace of arbitrarily long words in the XIs. And now just as above, the non-commutative moments of this n-tuple X completely determine the Feynman algebra generated by X. If you want to understand the Feynman algebra generated by X, you might as well go to the non-commutative moments. And this is what a microstate space does. It takes the data of the non-commutative moments and it geometrically embeds it into Euclidean space. And because you're in Euclidean space, you can apply all the analytic objects you have there, so measures, Hausdorff measures, packings, and so on. So, how do you define this? So if you have natural numbers m and k and gamma greater than 0, the m, k, gamma microstate space of X is the following. This is defined by Voicărescu, and it's denoted by gamma of X, m, k, gamma. So the definition is a bit unwieldy, so I'll do it twice. I'll do it once in a sentence, and then once with mathematical notation. So you're looking at all n-tuples, a1, an, of self-adjoint k by k matrices, such that the non-commutative moments of the ai agree with those of x, or of the xi, up to words of length m and tolerance gamma. So I didn't say this here, but X will always be this n-tuple. So I'm defining this set with respect to this n-tuple of self-adjoints in M. So again, the non-commutative moments of the AI agree with those of the XI up to words of length M and tolerance gamma. So what does that mean with mathematical notation if you prefer that? You let P be your word length, and again it's no more than M, so it's between 1 and M, and for any indices I1 through IP between 1 and n, you get that the trace of your xi1 ... xip This is from the corresponding trace of the AIs by no more than how much? Oh, gamma. That is your definition. Okay, so I said these microstates are somehow taking the non-commutative moments, which you're interested in because they determine your Feynman algebra, and they're embedding them into finite dimensional space where you can take advantage of all these tools. So, so notice that gamma x mk gamma, well, where does the space lie? It's in the n tuples of k by k self-adjoint matrices. And this is naturally isomorphic to Euclidean space of dimension nk squared, right? Now I'm going to tell you how to embed them. So if someone asks you for the norm of a1 through an, simply the Hilbert-Schmidt one, and I'm using a normalization here of the trace. Okay, so what we're interested in is when the size of the matrices which you're using to approximate the behavior is very large, and the degree of approximation is also very fine, meaning that you're going to permit words of very large length, and you're going to demand that the tolerance is very small. So it's a limit sort of thing. So let's do a simple example. So let's just look at the 2x2 matrices, which is about as simple as you can get when it comes to non-commutativity. No, it is the only thing, definitely the simplest thing you can do. So let's just see what these spaces look like. So here, my tracial Feynman algebra, the 2x2 matrices, I only have one trace on it, I have no choice, and now someone gives you some set, right? So here are two matrices. And now someone asks you, what are the microstates for this space X? Well, what's one microstate of X? The obvious candidate. Well, what does a candidate have to be? It's got to be a two-tuple. Each entry has to be a k-by-k matrix. And it should approximate, in some appropriate sense, the behavior of these two matrices, right? The obvious candidate is to simply amplify the behavior k times. So the amplification here is k over 2. I'll call this matrix AK, this matrix BK. Okay, so why is this matrix really a microstate for X? Well, it's simply the image of the canonical homomorphism from the 2x2 matrices into the k-by-k matrices, right? And that homomorphism preserves the trace, right? So all the non-commutative moments are preserved to a dot, at least when K is even. So this is, in fact, everything you could get. Well, wait, sorry. This is one of them that you could get. Jumping the gun here. Okay, so there's one candidate. So you want more, right? You want all of them. Well, you can do one simple thing, and that is you just take a unitary, any k by k unitary, and you look at the smear of psi k with this unitary. So you act on it, and by this, I mean you act on it for each entry. So you use the same unitary. The reason why this is true is that the moments of the unitary applied to this two-tuple, it has the exact same non-commutative moments as the thing on the top, right? Because you have a unitary and it cancels out. So, in fact, this is all you get. So, in fact, the microstate space of X, mk gamma, is the unitary orbit of psi k. This has very little to do with the fact that it's a 2x2 matrix. It works for any finite dimensional. The Neumann algebra has nothing to do with the fact that it's finite dimensional. It's really just injectivity. And that's an exact characterization. So the statement is, if for any m, k, gamma, there exists a psi k in the microstate space, such that you can describe the microstate space by that smear, so it's the orbit psi k. This happens if and only if the Neumann algebra generated by X is injective. Okay, so now I've defined these sets, and you need some sort of measurement of the sets if you want to come up with some sort of Neumann algebra invariant, right? You have all these sets, these sequences of sets. What are you going to do with them? Right? You can't, like, can't even draw them out in case four. Well, maybe you could, but it'd be very hard to see what they look like. So you need a measurement on the spaces, right? You need to measure their size or some property of the spaces. And this is where geometric measure theory comes in. So Boyko-Rescu defined a quantity which he called free entropy dimension, and he conjectured that this might be a Neumann algebra invariant, that it might tell you something about the Neumann algebra generated by X. And when I was computing some elementary examples, I ended up using coverings instead of the original version which Boyko-Rescu defined. And then I later found out that the whole concept could be described entirely in terms of coverings. So it was enough to look at coverings. So this is what I'm going to discuss now. And I'll review the notion of a covering. So you have a pre-compact metric space. And for any epsilon greater than 0, k epsilon omega, this will be the minimum number of open epsilon balls required to cover omega. Now the covering dimension of omega is, so what you do here is you take a limb soup, so you're forcing a limit on the following quotient. You take log of the minimum number of epsilon balls required to cover omega, and you normalize by the absolute value of log epsilon. So notice, at least as far as structure goes, the only thing you need here is a metric space. No manifold, no V group, no other structure. It's bare bones. So what are some examples? What are some examples of this sort of a computation? Let's do some simple ones. So let's start with the unit interval. So if omega is 0, 1, how many epsilon balls or epsilon intervals are required to cover 0, 1? 1 over epsilon, right? About. Maybe it's 2, it's about 1 over epsilon. So if you just plug that into the top equation, what you get is the following. So you take a limb soup as epsilon goes to 0 of the log of the, well, take log of 1 over epsilon, and you divide by log epsilon. And now I'm going to impose a 1 here just because it'll be useful in my next example. So I'm going to really force the 1 to be here. The log will take the 1 and push it out in front. You get log epsilon over log epsilon and absolute value, and they'll cancel, right? So you get 1. The unit interval has dimension 1, which is what you would expect. Okay, so let's do something slightly more complicated. You take the unit interval and you Cartesian product it with itself. So in this case, the covering number is not, it's not 1 over epsilon, it's 1 over epsilon squared, right? So then when you play this whole game again, well, instead of getting 1 over epsilon to the 1, you get it to the 2. Now the 2 pops out, right? The log epsilons cancel. This is 2. One more example, let's do the Cantor set. So, the standard middle thirds Cantor set. So if you want to cover it with 1 over 3 to the n intervals, well, that's 2 to the n by construction. So, if you take a Lin soup as n goes to infinity of this whole thing, then you get log of 2 to the n over log 1 over 3 to the n. That's the value. And again, the n's both pop out, right? So you get log 2 over log 3. I've actually cheated here, right? I haven't done it for every epsilon greater than 0, but replace it with a ln or something like this. It actually is log 2 over log 3 in full generality. Okay, so again, this notion of dimension only requires a metric space, right? And it requires that it be pre-compact. Well, that's exactly what we have in this setting, right? There are Euclidean subsets. You have a metric on it given by this guy right here. So just whack it with all of this stuff and see what happens. You take an asymptotic limit and you get some quantity, which would be the free entropy dimension. What you do here for any m and gamma and epsilon, you take an asymptotic limit the following quantity. So remember your microstate spaces have three quantities here, and I've added another one, the epsilon. So I get rid of the k first, which is the size of the matrices. So this is the Lin soup. This epsilon goes to 0. K to the negative 2 times log. Here I put the covering number of the space. And this is taken with respect to this 2 norm, right here. So I've actually absorbed the log into the definition, right? So I don't need to worry about that. And then I get rid of the degree of approximation. Yes, thank you. K goes to infinity. I take k epsilon of x, I take a limit, and I force the degree of approximation to be finer and finer. And now you have some sort of asymptotic epsilon covering number of your space, and now just take that same definition and plug it in. And you should get some kind of number. So, this again wasn't how Wojtkowski originally defined the quantity, but it's equivalent. So, the free entropy dimension of X is, so it's denoted by delta naught X, as we saw in several other talks, and you do the same thing. You take a Lin soup, epsilon goes to 0, k epsilon x over log epsilon. Okay, so delta naught is some number which is defined in terms of your generating set x, right? Yep.
Something that I've always had trouble understanding is why the k squared should go outside the log.
Well, for the same reason. But if this were not 2 but k squared, what would you want to whack it by? You'd want a k to the negative 2 to wait there so it could die when it comes out of the log. So if you have, so generally when you take log of any quantity, any function, and it, you know it grows exponentially, and you know t is approaching some limit, you take log of this, and gt is waiting here, and you want this thing to converge, right? So what do? You do the dimensional estimate thing, and you kill it with its inverse. That's all we're doing here. We're killing it with its inverse, which is k to the negative 2. Okay, so where was I? Right, so delta naught is some number which reflects a property about the tuple, right? And I kept muttering something about phenomenon algebra invariance, right? So here's the natural question. So what happens if you take two different sets which generate the same von Neumann algebra? Do they have the same free entropy dimension? Known as the invariance problem. If you answer this in the affirmative, then you solve the free group factor conjecture problem, right? And if you answered in the negative with the counterexample, you publish it into a top-notch journal, probably, and there'll be people like me crying or something like that. I don't know. No, it's probably not true in general. But it should be true in some natural cases. Okay, so the covering description of delta naught, one of its advantages is that it allows for computations in many situations that weren't possible with the original definition Voicalescu had. And so encouraged by this, I started looking at more geometric measure theoretic formulations and ideas. So this is in terms of coverings, right? Not in terms of some epsilon semicircular family. I think some of you guys are nodding your head so you know what the original definition looked like. And that's very much in the vein of GMT, or geometric measure theory. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the following. So what does geometric measure theory do? It studies sets which are typically pathological, right? A Cantor set, or some set generated by an iteration function scheme. So they're usually unwieldy. They're not manifolds, right? So the only structure you have is some sort of metric. But even in this setting, you still have structure results. You actually have a lot of structure results. So even in this kind of Spartan setting, you still have structure results which classify your sets up to a geometric measure theoretic notion of equivalence. So these microstate spaces, they're huge sets. We don't understand them very well. But in the very least, they should be amenable to a geometric measure theoretic application. You should be able to at least analyze the sets themselves. And ideally, that sort of structure theorem should translate to a von Neumann algebra structure theorem. And the situation, at least one situation where this is possible, is with Besicovitch's theorem. So that's what I'm going to talk about now. So I guess 80 years ago, Besicovitch was interested in classifying all sets with dimension 1. So you start with a Borel set in R2. And if you know that its Hausdorff measure, so its linear measure, is non-degenerate, so it's greater than 0 and it's not infinite, then you can decompose it into a good and a bad set. And the bad set you throw away. You just don't do anything with it. So B is totally unrectifiable. But the good news is that G can be contained in a countable union of rectifiable curves. You can, in fact, I think, more or less assume it is a countable union of rectifiable curves. So the picture you should have here is that you take some diffeomorphic copies of the unit interval, you twist them, you can put edges on them, but not too many. So you don't get to do anything like the Weierstrass function. You have measure 0, non-differentiable points, but aside from that, it's just a countable union of unit intervals. Okay, so I was wondering if there's a analog of this, a structure theorem which would not only tell you how the microstate space decomposes, but also whether it would have any sort of invariance issues. It'd have a relation to the invariance question with delta naught. So here's the analog. No, B can in fact have positive Hausdorff measure. But it has every local density is irregular, meaning that if you take a small epsilon ball and you intersect it with that set, and you take the Hausdorff 1 measure of that, and you compare it to what the Hausdorff 1 measure of a line of radius R should be, so 2R, that thing does not converge to 1. And it fails to have a local density there. You can always split a set up into those which have a local density 1 and those which don't. And you play a game there, but I think typically the GMT people just forget about it. They forget about that set and, you know, throw it away. So Besicovitch's microstate analog is this. So you start with this N tuple X. And the assumptions that you have on X are the following. So if there exists a constant K such that the epsilon covering number of X is no more than log epsilon plus K, and you assume something more. So this condition right here is analogous to this inequality right here. Okay? So I'm trying to mimic exactly what Bessie's doing. Up here, Besicovitch is doing this right here. I'm demanding that it's no more than log epsilon plus k. I'm not doing it in terms of Hausdorff measure either, although that could be possible. So that's for the top, and I got to mimic it with another inequality. So the other inequality is that bounded from below by the following. So notice here that I'm putting the x1. That is really the first entry of my x. So this all happens for epsilon sufficiently small. Everything happens locally, so it doesn't have to be true for all epsilon. So under these conditions, so for epsilon sufficiently small, so this is a hypothesis. Then, if you start with any other finite tuple, y, and you know that it generates the same von Neumann algebra as x, then it satisfies the same bounds. This will imply that the covering number of y is no more than log epsilon plus k1 for epsilon sufficiently small. And some constant k1. So notice that in this beginning part of the theorem, you have a bound of k epsilon x, right? If you divide by the absolute value of log epsilon, what do you get on this side? You get exactly the quotient which appears in the definition of free entropy dimension. What do you get on this side if you divide by log epsilon? Log epsilon over log epsilon is 1. K over log epsilon, well, log epsilon goes to infinity, right? So it's k over log epsilon, so that quantity goes to 0. So the hypothesis guarantees that the free entropy dimension of X is less than or equal to 1. That same argument works here too, right? Same kind of bound. So in particular, the free entropy dimension of Y is no more than 1. If you assume R omega embeddability then the free entropy dimension is 1. So delta naught is a von Neumann algebra invariant, and its value is 1. So you start from one specific set, and it propagates to the entire von Neumann algebra. So it's not clear why you would have any von Neumann algebra applications. You do, but I'm not going to talk about them right now. I'm just going to give you a sketch of the proof. So I'm going to try and show you why the usual or the the obvious attempt to show that free entropy dimension is a phenomenon algebra invariant fails. And I'll show you how to fix it with this condition. So here's the idea. So what do you want? You want this, right? This is in terms of y. You want a bound k epsilon y from above. Well, what is y? It's in the same phenomenon algebra as x, since I'm giving you a sketch of the proof. I can write y is equal to f of x, right? Okay. So, let's see what you can do. So you take k epsilon of y. Say, okay, I replace y with f of x. Okay. And then you hope that f is Lipschitz, maybe. Okay, so it's Lipschitz. So, meaning that if f stretches by, let's say, a constant 2, then it stretches any epsilon ball by no more than 2. And this will give you a bound in terms of the covering numbers. So I put cf over here. And now I get my x here, right? And then you use your bound right there. So this is no more than log epsilon over cf plus k. And the cf comes out. What you get is log epsilon plus log cf plus k. And then you find out where you've cheated. Because the problem here is with this heuristic argument. You say fx is equal to y. Well, unless you know strong enough things about f, this argument fails, right? It's like saying that any GMT dimension is a Borel morphism, which is absurd, right? It doesn't happen that way. So you have to do something, because how do you approximate y? You take polynomials in x, right? What do you know about the derivatives or the Lipschitz constants of the polynomials? Nothing. They go to infinity, probably. And then you're screwed, right? You can't do anything. All right, so the argument here is to actually take Besicovitch's theorem and use the group symmetry being the unit interval, to cut the space apart. You decompose the space using Besicovitch's theorem. And when you sort of, you can think of it as a foliation or a group action, when you cut that space up into a group piece and what's left over, and you apply this argument, the group piece is so nice that you just throw it away. It does nothing. It doesn't care about any of the weird morphisms. But the small piece, the potentially very bad piece, is so small that no matter what your function does, no matter how hard it tries to distort the space, it loses in the end. So it's a case of divide and conquer, where you conquer it with a group action, and then you have this leftover piece, and you break it up. Okay, so what does Besicovitch say? Oh, it's right here. He says that. So, again, I'll just assume that my space is a countable union of rectifiable curves. So it says that omega looks like this. Okay, so I have a countable number of vertices, which I'll call V. So I'll mark out all these points where I've drawn a bubble. And then what I have left are these unit intervals. So up to measure 0, this looks like 0, 1 cross V, right? You have a countable set V, and you have some unit intervals 0, 1. Okay, well, what you can do in the microstate space, so here you have your group symmetry 0, 1, and then you have your bad set V, right? The set of V is just a discrete set of countable discrete set. And your unit action, your unit interval action, is just tracing out the shape of the space. So you have one obvious symmetry in the microstate space, and that's unitary conjugacy, right? But those 2x2 matrices, how did you get all the other ones? You just took its unitary orbit. Well, it's true that if you take any microstate space and you let the unitaries act that way, it leaves the space invariant. So you can do the exact same thing. So you effectively mod out by the unit. Sorry. So cellular learning. You want help by the unitary action. So you fix some microstate for x1, and you define the following. So you define all the microstates for x2 through xn, which are compatible with x1. Turns out with no assumptions on X, that you can break the space up now into the following. So this quantity will be about equal to the unitary orbit of psi k cross this relative microstate space. This is what I'm calling the relative microstate space of X2 through Xn. And it's a byproduct of the microstate's machinery that this unitary orbit can be written as a true Cartesian product, in terms of asymptotics at least. And the UK, this guy, I'm thinking of as the unit interval. Now, everything that I've written up to here works for any general x, but what I want to do is, when I assume that x satisfies this bound in the hypothesis, what that forces on this residual set is that this is like V. What is it about V that I want to use? It's very small. A countable set of points with respect to Hausdorff one measure is negligible. You can just throw it away. And that's the point here, that this bound in the hypothesis of the theorem forces this quantity to actually stay bounded regardless of what epsilon is. As epsilon gets smaller, the number of epsilon balls required to cover a space grow exponentially, right? And the funny thing is that the hypothesis in that theorem says this thing doesn't even grow. It stays bounded by k. It's constant k. So now you can apply this, you can apply this proof. By the way, if your y's are polynomials and your x's, this proof shows why delta naught is an algebraic invariant immediately, right? Because your CF will only depend on one set of functions, and they're polynomials. So they have bounded derivatives on bounded sets. So that's why delta naught's an algebraic invariant. It works for any Lipschitz calculus. Okay, so... All right. So I want to bound k epsilon of y. Well, because x and y generate the same thing, this is in fact true. And then, now you can apply the dummy estimate that I have up here. So I have this, so I've already applied F to my Y part, and now I use my relative microstate decomposition to write this as UK cross, and now I take the relative microstate of X2, XN, and K gamma, and then I've hit it with this funny F. Right, the F that potentially has horrible Lipschitz constant. And this actually becomes log epsilon. So here's where the covering estimate of the group sort of smooths things out. So you separate it into a good, bad, right? This is the good part, the group. This is a set of vertices. The good part is very good. So good, in fact, that you can just let K epsilon hit it. You have no problem here. This becomes log epsilon. And then what you get is K epsilon of this bad set, which we think of as the vertex set, and then you have this potentially bad F. Well, it doesn't matter how bad F gets. again, the decay in this set is so fast, right? That's the argument I was trying to place right here, that it doesn't matter. This is no more than log epsilon plus a potential change in your constant k. And that's it. That's the theorem. Okay, so this theorem has two consequences. Log epsilon. Where? Oh, sorry, yeah, it's plus, right, because it's a homomorphism. So, yeah, it's plus. Okay, so there are two consequences. This introduces a natural class of Feynman algebras. For which delta naught is an invariant. And in fact, its value is 1, and it's stable. So it's stable with respect to natural operations. And the second thing is that so it generalizes certain indecomposability properties of the free group factors. So what I'm talking about is Voigt-Kolescu with the absence of the Cartan, Gur with the primeness, Gur and Shen with the twisting unitaries, and then Maria Stefan with the finite index results. Okay, so you want Feynman algebra applications, and all I've stated so far is an abstract theorem which says if you know that the epsilon covering numbers of X satisfy some kind of funny bound, well then delta naught's an invariant for them and the quantity's 1. So what are these properties? So let me just make a definition. So if a Feynman algebra M is strongly one-bounded, if it does have a generating set X, as in theorem, so as in the Besicovitch theorem with the appropriate bounds. Okay, so notice, by the way, that if it is strongly one-bounded, delta naught is an invariant for it, and it's 1. So one theorem is the following. If M and N are strongly one-bounded, then the following are true. So one is that if the intersection is diffuse, the Feynman algebra generated by M and N is strongly one-bounded. The second condition is that the normalizer of M or N generates a strongly one-bounded Feynman algebra. Okay. So examples of this actually, well, there's several. First of all, it's just a Feynman algebra is injective. If it has property gamma, if it's non-prime, if it has Cartan, then it's strongly one-bounded. Of course, it doesn't react, well, it shouldn't react very well to free products, right? That's the whole point of free probability. So the other theorem is this. If you start with the family of R omega embeddable, Feynman algebras, if you're diffuse and you start with at least 2, the free product not strongly one-bounded. So in some sense, when you look at the truth of the strongly one-bounded, in the strongly one-bounded setting, you replace the unit interval with the UK action, right? And as Nate was talking about, the UK action represents injectivity. What you're effectively doing is breaking up, a strongly one-bounded from Norman algebra breaks up into manageable pieces of injective from Norman algebras. It's one way to look at it. And it can't, it somehow can't, it can't get into a free product. So, now examples of this would be, you take LF2, and it's not isomorphic, to a free product with amalgamation. S and the MIs are strongly one-bounded. D-diffuse. So actually I was talking to someone at the conference who is not here, fortunately, who was asking me why you didn't have an invariance property for something which had free entropy dimension greater than 1, that this number 1 is a special thing, right? Well, it is special in one situation, well, for one reason. If you could show that that delta naught was a von Neumann algebra invariant for something greater than 1, then you would effectively show that there exists a von Neumann algebra which can't be generated by less than that number of elements, which would be a big deal, right? Because today, I think it's still unknown whether any von Neumann algebra, any 2-1 factor can be generated by 1 plus epsilon elements, right? So the moment you get to that point, then you've done something very special, right? But too bad he's not here. Maybe I should have answered it. So I think that's it. I'll stop here.